This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk. Welcome. Happy New Year, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk.
Yay. Happy New Year.
Very good. All right. We're glad to be here.
Fantastic. Well, today we start the show off with an article, a study called Surviving and Thriving, The Fundamental Social Motives Provide Purpose in Life. Now, this is a 17-page article with five different studies, so I'm going to try to go through it briefly, but it might take a few minutes. So this is out of the Department of Psychology in Arizona State University, and it was published in the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. So just a couple of quotes from the article saying that prior research has provided two key insights that underlie this current study. One is that evolution by natural selection has probably not shaped humans to experience well-being or meaning. Rather, feelings of subjective well-being ought to be systematically calibrated to one's fitness. So this study, the authors write that they take the theoretical building block that evolved motives should exert a causal influence on purpose in life. And they're saying that humans are unlikely to have a general all-purpose fitness calibration mechanism. So instead, they suggest that we're likely to have a number of separate systems that gauge success in particular domains that correspond to challenges and opportunities that our ancestors faced. Now, as I was reading this article, I was like, man, this is all sounding so familiar. I wonder if they've listened to you, Dr. Hawk.
Right.
So anyway, the authors continue saying that this might mean that we gauge success separately for satisfying non-social physiological needs, protecting ourselves from physical attacks, making and keeping friends, winning respect in our social circles, acquiring mates, keeping mates, and then successfully caring for our offspring and other relatives. So from this, for the article, they took the theoretical perspective that not all the motives might promote purpose in life in the same ways. So they essentially investigated which motives influence purpose in life when it's pursued. And if purpose in life ultimately tracks pursuit of fitness-relevant goals, then the pursuit of the fitness-relevant goals should increase purpose in life. So these were five studies that were done to investigate the relationship between these fundamental motives and purpose in life. So study number one, they examined the relations of purpose in life to the fundamental motives that people credit for driving a self-chosen important goal pursuit. So instead of measuring the motives that people would pursue to find purpose in life, the study measured the motives that people are actually pursuing. And they found that the zero-order correlations revealed that disease avoidance, affiliation, and kin care related positively to purpose in life. And the observed correlation of disease avoidance motives and purpose in life were not predicted. And the predicted link with status did not emerge. So study number two examined the partial correlations between the motives and purpose in life among college students. And the reason they looked at college students was they were saying that people did not necessarily, in study one, people may not necessarily know what it is that's driving their behavior. So so it's unlikely, it said, that a lay person would know and report that status concerns would motivate the pursuit of, say, a graduate degree, when it's really just their intellectual curiosity that drove them there. So the hypothesis for study number two was that affiliation, status, and kin care motives would be positively correlated with purpose in life before and after controlling for personality. And the result? zero-order correlations revealed that positive relationships of purpose in life with self-protection, affiliation, status, and kin care. And this pattern held after they controlled for personality. And among those in a committed romantic relationship, purpose in life was not related actually to mate acquisition, but positively related to mate retention, which is kind of what we would expect. So study three, they sought to replicate the correlations of fundamental motives and purpose in life on a wider sample of adults. And their hypothesis was that the higher amounts of self-protection, affiliation, status, and kin care motives would predict a higher purpose in life. And the result was self-protection, affiliation, status, and kin care had zero order correlations with purpose in life. And after they controlled for all the criteria, only affiliation, status, and kin care motives predicted the higher amounts of purpose in life. And so that suggests a reliable and unique relationship of purpose in life with affiliation, status, and kin care. But that individuals motivated to pursue affiliation, status, and kin care motives tend to have more purpose in life. So study number four, they were testing causality in the three fundamental social domains. Now, they said there were seven social domains, but funding prevented them from doing all seven, so they only could do two or three of them. So the hypothesis was they expected kin care to have the largest effect on purpose in life, status to have the smaller effect, and mate acquisition to have zero effect. It turns out that the results show that the correlations among fundamental motives and purpose in life echoed those in the previous study, that purpose in life correlated with kin care, R equals 0.282, and the status, which was R equals 0.189, but not with mate acquisition, which was a negative 0.059. And study number five, they wanted to replicate study number four with pre-tested confounding variables that assessed the randomization of these variables. And there were several hypotheses, but essentially the results were that a planned comparison of the three combined motive conditions with the control condition turned up non-significant results in the expected direction. And hypothesis number two showed no significant differences between motive conditions. And number three, the simple comparisons showed that the effects on purpose in life were non-existent in the status condition, nearly significant in the mating condition, and significant in the kin care condition. And the fourth hypothesis was that status motive was not significantly higher in the status condition than the combined other conditions. The contrast was 0.59, and mate acquisition was not higher in the mating condition than the combined other conditions. So the results were that they replicated a causal effect of writing about mating and kin care, but not status. And the post-test showed that the manipulations did not affect amount of fundamental motivation per se, suggesting that motive satisfaction feelings may have increased the purpose in life. Now, through this whole study, as I was reading the conclusion, the results discussion, the last paragraph really spoke to me. Just based on everything that I've heard from you, Dr. Lyle, and you, Dr. Jen Hawk, which is the authors write that the current work might seem uncomfortably reductionistic to some because it claims that humans' lofty perceptions of purpose in life partially reflect their pursuit of mundane social goals. But is that really reducing anything? Viewed differently, the findings suggest that humanity finds purpose in doing what comes naturally.
Yeah.
Oh.
Took a really fancy study to show
This is grand. This is entertaining
for
both Jen and I to listen to. we're watching Jen, who recently escaped academia. We get to watch how carefully and how tentatively people have to gently push forward any evolutionary theory into the ring. Like
even in the the journal of what journal was it in? Personality, and it's not the journal of Personality and Social Psychology
and
Bulletin.
And Social Psychology Bulletin.
Yeah. Yep. So they even have to hedge it that carefully, and that it's just these tiny little baby steps that are fundamentally saying, humans aren't motivated by grand goals. That's not where their purpose comes from. Their purpose comes from a systematic process of daily achievement toward competitively relevant activity. So, yeah, okay.
Very, very carefully. Very carefully. And like, it's partially related. No, actually, dude, it's entirely related. Every single flicker of every little whisker of every animal that ever lived was aimed at survival of reproductive goals, period.
Yeah.
So
that's really all there is to say.
Sorry. But this is, and so all of this sort of junk survey data that he has in there, and that they're sort of grinding away correlation coefficients and seeing if it's supported here or supported there. I applaud the fact that they're even collecting data on it, and then they're like very scared, you know, I don't know, like a scared child, you know, showing dad that there's a worm in the garden, like that wasn't supposed to be there.
It's like you've talked about this in the platter trap before, and you said it was like a Buddhist in the Vatican, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is a Buddhist in the Vatican approach. Super careful, really careful. It's amazing to me that, you know, having read The Adapted Mind in 1982, that here we are 28 years later. The adapted mind that was obviously massively more confident and revolutionary in its tone 28 years ago. Now, 28 years later, finally in a this is a mainline journal, the Personality and Social Psych Bulletin. I think I have a pub in that journal.
So it must be legitimate.
from way back in the day. Okay, this is a standard APA journal. So the... So here we are, just ever so gently tipping a little tiny pebble into the pond so that it can be discussed. I mean, I can't fault it. But whoever this person is, good for them. They've gone and done some work. But, you know, this isn't David mm-hmm. Buss. David Buss wouldn't talk this way, and he wouldn't be so tentative. But they did go out there and collect some data. Here's another way you could do it. Instead of gently asking people these things, why don't we just go and go to the mall and get some data on what people mm-hmm. buy? Okay, let's find out what they're actually doing with their money, which is effectively their time. Let's find out what they're doing, or do a content analysis on what's on television. All right, so let's find out, you know, what people are watching and what the content is of those things. And what we're going to find is a very short, direct line between evolutionary problems and what it is that people are fascinated with. So, yeah, so it's interesting that you talked about seven social things. God knows what those are. I mean, it'd be kind of interesting to look at their taxonomy. But for me, I see a few. So I see friendship, romance, children. Relationships in with us and workplace decisions on the other side of the equation, either customers or bosses, etc. In other words, somebody who's hiring us and trading with our efforts for money, and then finally, I would call that would be pseudo esteem. So it would be generalized status where people don't know our work directly, but they have some notion of who it is that we are and what we are noted for, good or bad, as a result of reputational transmission of information. I don't know that there's any other relationships between people that people pursue. I believe that there's one more, which would be theoretically enemies or rivals. That's another relationship we could have with other people. But yeah, fair enough. So there, what a surprise. So when we start looking at, you know, that what people are pursuing, it has something to do with their evolutionary design. The fact that they are so tentative is really illuminating. And how absurd it is that we are tentative here tells you something about the massive anti-biological and it's frankly anti-logical influence that has infected the social sciences for 100 years. Yeah. So there's dogs barking in Jen's apartment, yes. Just cheering. Oh, they're just cheering what I'm saying.
Howling has begun, actually. We've got full on, it's very impressive. I don't know what's going on, but this is a rare moment. We should all just sit back and bask Yes.
Yeah.
So now, what anyway. Was interesting is, yeah, is in one of the studies, they had a citation talking about how some fundamental motives are framed as preventing harm, like disease avoidance, whereas others are framed as acquiring gains, so like, you know, pursuing a mate. But they said it makes a difference as people essentially, they work longer at tasks that are aimed at gains than those that are aimed at preventing losses. In other words, playing to win is better than playing not to lose.
Well, you know, that all depends on whether or not the Romans are attacking your fort. Okay, so this is entirely context dependent. We're talking about a bunch of middle class kids in a university setting. Yeah, they're not having to play defense. They're not having to make sure that they don't starve to death or they're infected by termites or something. They've got a very cushy existence, and they are obviously able to, in a relaxed fashion, turn their attention towards trying to rise in dominance hierarchies. That's all fine. But I mean, we have to back up and look at context.
That's true. And then those college students wouldn't necessarily be avoiding disease in the same way that someone who's maybe 60 or 70 or 40 or 50 with high blood pressure.
They're not avoiding anything. they're in a place in their life where they're absolutely situated toward advancement, toward improvement, and like Doug's saying, dominance hierarchies. So their whole life is built around that. So that's going to be borne out in these results. But yeah, you check back in with them, you know, in a couple decades when they're trying to avoid their relationships and avoid their health issues and avoid everything else that has gone wrong with them, and it may look very different.
All right. Well, speaking of health issues, speaking of health issues, now we are now our first live show of the new year of 2020. Mm. And aside from bad 2020 jokes and hindsight's always 2020, it turns out, I guess now everyone's going to be starting their New Year's resolutions. So our first question is, where do New Year's resolutions come from? Why start something on January 1st or Monday or, you know, whatever it is versus any other random day?
Yeah, I'll jump in here because I've gotten a lot of questions about this recently and talked to a lot of people who are making resolutions and wondering how to best make resolutions. I think the reason that there's a collective move toward this is because it essentially is a little bit anti-ego trapping, in the sense that the expectations are a little bit lowered because everybody's transforming their lives today. Everybody's turning over a new leaf and nobody really expects anyone to make good on it. So that, in addition to the fact that this is just the kind of culturally agreed upon first day of the new year, fresh start, we're finally going to take some action on all of those competitive goals that have been following us around and that we've been acutely aware of for the last 365 days. This is it. This is when we do it. So I mean, there's nothing magical about January 1st. I don't think it has anything to do with the astrology of the Capricorn season or the phase of the moon or anything like that. I think this is just a cultural moment. And it's very much like this is the one time a year where you can go in and announce to the office that you just signed up for a gym membership and you're going to do things differently this year. And people don't hold those expectations against you the way that they're going to the rest of the year, because it's just a New Year's resolution. So you can have a high expectation for yourself, but you kind of have this comfort of knowing that you're in a position where you could outperform people's expectations. And there's not much more motivating than that. That's the opposite of the ego trap, when people are expecting more from you than you think you can deliver. So this at least it starts off with a nice little motivational boost that gets a lot of people going. Of course, it doesn't really last very long for most resolutions, because most people are making resolutions that are objective based, not process based. But that's a whole other question.
Well, maybe we can talk about another show. I want to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
let's talk about the process based goals versus objective based goals.
Yeah. I mean, that is the heart of any goal setting and any motivational process, but particularly if you're trying to make a successful New Year's goal, is people fall into this trap of linking their objective to all of the external esteem that they think that they're going to harvest when they accomplish that objective. So they're going to lose 100 pounds. and that's going to make them much more attractive as a mate, and it's going to make that, you know, more popular at work or whatever. They're anticipating this big competitive payoff to accomplishing the goal. So they have an objective-based goal, you know, make a bunch of money, or you know, get a promotion, or lose a bunch of weight, or whatever it is. And it's important to have these goals, and it's important to be very specific about them. That's part of the motivational magic, is to have a very specific, competitively relevant goal, because you're not going to feel the motivation to accomplish anything unless it carries some sort of significant payoff with it in terms of what it's going to do for your projected esteem situation in the future. So it's not that having objective-based goals are necessarily bad, but the problem is that most people stop there. So they write their little list and they make their little resolutions. And so we can just do weight loss for an example, because that's obviously the most common resolution that people have, because it's the most competitively relevant problem for a lot of people, probably most people. So they say, oh, I want to lose 50 pounds this year. And this is great. But then they get into, you know, week two, and they haven't gone to the gym for a couple days in a row, and they've gotten into some indulgent food, and they feel like, well, whatever, I guess I missed the boat this year and I didn't do it, because they didn't set up what the daily fundamentals were going to be on a regular basis to accomplish that goal. And the little fundamentals that are the process are what you really need to be attuning yourself to, because that's going to give you, it actually goes back to that article that we're talking about. That article is saying that the sense of purpose and joy in life is very linked to progress, not achievement per se. It's progress toward achieving something really important. And so that's what we're wanting to orient ourselves to in the process of any kind of New Year's resolution. So instead of, you know, asking yourself whether you've accomplished the outcome of a goal, you're looking at whether you did the basics that are eventually inevitably going to get you to where you want to be today. And this initiates the whole self-esteem process, which we've talked about a lot in other episodes. And that really is kind of a whole separate question, but the process of developing pride in your ability to take action towards something that is competitively important for you really is the secret of feeling fulfilled and feeling like you're making meaningful progress toward a goal. So that's essentially what kind of New Year's resolution you want to have, and how you should reframe your New Year's resolutions if you want to not hit your first roadblock and turn the table over.
Dr. Lyle, can we get a comment from you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is exactly how I view it. And so at the risk of being redundant, I'll just sort of put it in my own words, which is that what I want people to do is I want them to become fascinated with the mechanics of their self-esteem mechanism. And what Jen and I want to do is we want to separate out the self-esteem mechanism from the self-confidence mechanism and the esteem mechanism. Those are three different mechanical devices inside the brain. So the self-esteem mechanism is the internal audience's feedback to the self as it observes your efforts. It's essentially a moral quality feedback device. That's different than the excitement and motivation that comes from the self-confidence or self-efficacy mechanism, which is tracking your successes, tracking progress. That thing is very potent because it's running, it's a derivative of cost-benefit analysis on whether your improvements are lining up to the efforts well, and whether the efforts look like they're paying off. And then finally, the big payoff is the esteem that we're aiming at that comes from other people when they observe our progress. So three different psychological events, three different types of feeling. All of them are feedback devices for different components of a human project, of a human competitive effort. So the one that that Jen and I are inherently fascinated about, and we want our clients to become fascinated about, is the one that is completely ignored, and that is the self-esteem mechanism.
Because it's the most subtle. It's the quietest.
And it's by far the quietest and most subtle, but it's the one that if you are actually going to try to take on a big goal this year, this is the one that you need to learn about. So I was just speaking with a man today that very bright, affable, capable, smart, successful, and he's 100 plus pounds overweight. And this has been this way for an awful long time. And he's, you know, he was all ready to dig in and to find out the magic from me about what you know, what's the guru say about this? And what the guru said is, we're going to do very simple things and you're going to do them perfectly this week. And maybe you will and maybe you won't. And most people won't. But so I started hearing excuses about, you know, how challenging his work is, and you know, isn't the issue the stress of the work and how he doesn't deal with stress well, and, you know, et cetera, the emotional addiction, blah, blah, blah. I said, no, it's got nothing to do with it. This is, the fact is very few people have a combination of conscientiousness and motivation that is at an intense enough level to battle against the pleasure trap. It's just not, it's not common. And so to do this on an outpatient basis and to do it well enough with respect to your, to do an outstanding job so that you can reacclimate your taste buds so that the price is not very high for eating excellently healthy foods consistently. In order to accomplish that, very difficult to do. And the way that you would accomplish it is watch very, very carefully for a beautiful feeling that'll take place probably within a week of perfection. And that feeling is the self-esteem mechanism. So for his whole life, for as long as he can remember, there's been an internal audience chirping disgust at him. And he's been told by legions of other psychologists that those negative self-talks are the reasons why he's self-destructive. Okay? That is a total reversal of causality. The reason why he's got the internal negative voices is because he is being self-destructive. Okay, it's not the other way around. And so it's going to turn out that if he behaves in an excellent fashion with relentless self-discipline, at the end of a week, he's going to find essentially like sunshine for the first time in his life, and he's never seen it before. That the clouds will go away and the sun will come out and there will be a brilliant blue sky. And on the inside of his brain, the internal audience will say, you know, well done, Neiman. Well job. Good, excellent job. This is no joke. You've gone a week. Now, again, as Jen was saying, hey, he's 103 pounds overweight, not 105. There's no difference that anybody in the world can see, except one entity, his internal audience can tell. Okay, and finding the shutdown switch for the constant chronic internal negative feedback that the self-esteem mechanism will generate if you continue to do things that are subverting your competitive success or your health. If you can find the shutdown switch for that and you can feel it and see exactly what took place to shut it down, what a tremendous sense of power over your own life experience to discover that switch. So that's what we try to sell. And if you can't do it on your own, you try, which I explained that I would not expect him to do this. I learned enough about his personality. He's pretty open to experience. He's not super conscientious. He's smart. He's pretty conscientious, but he's pretty open. Oops. Okay. Danger. Okay. And so you may need help, and that's where a place like Fasting Escape comes in. That's what you got to go to jail. Okay. Now, in jail, some, you know, the inmates teach us some cool stuff. what happens is that you get to go through a process of essentially watching what happens to your nervous system and the reacclimation of the taste buds, not to mention some rapid changes in your health towards the positive. And so the cost-benefit analysis now looks different after you've had some major significant successes after a couple of weeks.
You force the self-esteem.
What's that?
Because you're in jail and you're doing the right thing because yes. you have to, and then you know you hit the shutdown switch inadvertently, and so you get a few days in and you're
That's
feeling
right.
really diligent and really competent, and you're that feeling of pride surges and you start to feel it. This is what alcoholics call the pink cloud. You know, there's nothing magical going on with the pink cloud in early sobriety that people talk about in 12-step. It's the perception that you've stopped the massive, massive sabotage and you've turned off that chirping little voice of disgust in your mind that is really upset with you because you've now turned the ship around and you were doing the basics toward what you ultimately need to accomplish. There's a long way to go. There's a lot of recovery ahead, but you've stopped actively sabotaging yourself, and that results in an immense feeling of just pride. It's just feeling really good about what you're doing and where you're heading.
Yeah. The beautiful thing is that in very short order, the pride mechanism can go on through the self-esteem mechanism can go on as loud as it can ever go on. Okay. In other words, it won't go on any louder. But it's a beautiful thing to shut down the internal criticism. Now, other things will enhance the process. So, for example, evidence that we're actually having success. Now, that will influence self-confidence, and that influences energies directed towards the problem. Also, feedback from the outside world that they can see your success. That's huge. Those are both way louder mechanisms. The self-esteem mechanism is a quiet, subtle internal governor. And yet, it's like the atoms, okay? And the self-confidence mechanism is like molecules. And actual esteem from real-life people is like an apple. It's a big thing. It's like it's the big thing that we're seeking. But the apple's just made out of atoms. That's what it's made out of. And so if we don't understand what is the fundamental roots of success, then we're not very likely to be successful in the face of really challenging problems like getting out of the pleasure trap. So, yeah, this is a great question. This whole New Year's deal, I just love Jen's analysis that this is a time and a place that culturally that the ego trap is muted. It's fantastic. I feel the same thing myself. I feel latitude towards, you know, saying, okay, it's time to, now you're going to try to make some changes. And I feel a little enthusiasm because I can feel the muting of the ego trap around that. So that's a great insight. And this is a terrific time for people to take advantage of that abatement of the ego trap counter pressure. And this is also a good time that, you know, if you make a good run at something and you get stopped with respect to health kinds of issues, it's a real good time to start plotting when you're going to get some help and when you may want to go to jail.
Well, thank you. That's some wonderful answers. And I really guys appreciate you promoting Fasting Escape. It's for people who want to go to jail, you can go to fastingescape.com.
Yeah. It's very, very pleasant.
There you
jail.
Go. Yeah. Yeah, we'd say positive things about True North,
they're
but they're
super full. They're
Forget
full
it.
For months.
You know, so it's Fasting Escape's
nicer. They'll
be full
nicer. Until New Year's 2021.
I like Fasting Escape better. Yeah. Fasting Escape's quieter and nicer. True North has too many people buzzing around and too much traffic noise. That's my take.
I hear really good things about Nate's skills in the kitchen as well.
You know, we've been talking about New Year's resolutions, and you talked about the number one resolution is weight loss. And Dr. Hawk, you answered it. The next question was, why is it the number one weight loss? Why is the number one resolution weight loss? And I think you answered it, which is it's the most important competitive problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the next question is
most relevant.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
the
no,
most
that,
relevant.
It's just,
sorry,
yeah,
me.
The most relevant, most the one that people perceive that they could solve, and they get frustrated because they know in principle how to solve it, and they keep running into the inability to solve it. So it sort of just dangles there, like, oh, I can really get my act together this year. So it makes itself more available as a resolution than other things that people might, in you know, at some level want to accomplish, but they have no idea how to go about it or what it would even look like. So this is something that. That people, you know, very often have done successfully at some point in the past. They've got some sense of the process, and it's obviously hugely, hugely relevant to competitive realities, particularly, well, for everyone, but for women and their mate value in particular. So, yeah, very common resolution.
Mm-hmm. And so the next question is, oh, yeah, Dr. Lyle, did you have a comment? Of course,
no.
you did the video that I've recommended and I have on the website as well, Losing Weight Without Losing Your Mind. And it's just, you know, every time someone is willing to watch the whole video, it's like they walk away just completely, I wouldn't say sold, because it's not a sales job. It's really educated and the distortions surrounding weight loss are corrected.
Yeah, that really is the only video that people need to watch and understand, because it covers the whole thing, and it's, you know, has great art and it's funny.
And you're introduced by Chef AJ.
Yeah, the
it's
one
also
thing,
wonderful as well.
Yeah, the one thing that I would add to that, which I now know a major fact that I didn't know when we did that video, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. And that is that, you know, I knew when I wrote The Pleasure Trap and when I spoke on that topic that genes were a major factor. And I have a graph in the book showing that. But now I know that the genes are even a bigger, quite a bit bigger factor than I thought as a result of Ploman's work. And so now I recognize, you know what, the truth is, this is very, you know, pretty much, I've been saying for a long time, pretty much everybody in the culture eats about the same. I mean, there are a few percentages of people that are super vigilant and really health-oriented, and probably a high percentage of our listeners are those people. But just as a general population phenomenon, pretty much everybody in the culture pretty much eats the same thing. And the reason I say this with confidence is that I live in a city, Elk Grove, 160 or 70,000 people. There's not one salad bar in this place. Okay, we're not in, I don't know, rural Kentucky. That's not where we are. I'm essentially in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and there is not a salad bar restaurant now. So, what? Obviously, we know what people are eating here. They're eating at Chili's. They're eating at Kentucky Fried Chicken, there's McDonald's, et cetera. We can tell what they're eating because that's what's here. So we know what people are eating, which means that the vast majority of people are eating, you know, essentially what we call a standard American diet. It isn't 60%. It's not 70%. It's 96%. And so as a result, when we see the variances in people's weight, we're simply looking at genetic differences. Because the environment is effectively a constant. So people that struggle with their weight, it's like, hey, listen, folks, the thin people are not more emotionally balanced than you. Well, they may be because they're not fighting that particular emotional problem, the fallout that comes from the weight problems. But they are not more conscientious than you and doing a better job. They are not more emotionally stable. They're not less neurotic. They aren't anything. There's no difference in the personalities. The only difference is some metabolic changes as a result of gene differences that lead one person to be 100 pounds overweight and the next person to be 0 pounds overweight. The reasons are genetic. Now, so everybody's eating the same crap. Some people show evidence on their bodies. Most people do in moderate amounts. Some people in huge amounts, and some people in none. Okay, now we say, oh, wow, is that the issue? Yeah, that's the issue. Now, that being the case, it is not a sentence, because the way out is to get out of the pleasure trap. You're like, oh, okay.
That's easy.
Well, that
yeah, okay,
good.
Just do that.
So, yeah, so, oh, that's what it is. Oh,
Okay. So then they try it. And then, of course, they fail. And then they may try again, or maybe they don't. Or maybe they go 10 years goes by, and then they pick up the old McDougal program again and do it for like three or four days, and then they don't do it again. And they shrug their shoulders, and they feel defeated and overwhelmed and kind of self-disgusted and et cetera, et cetera, right? They have no idea what has just transpired. The truth is that the pleasure trap is vastly underestimated. And even people very close to us in this field, people that Jen and I know, big shot doctors, they are thinking there's some underlying psychological mumbo jumbo that is causing people to be unable to do this. And they're mistaken. There is no psychological mumbo jumbo. Okay? All there is a ubiquitous phenomenon of the genes of the species being consistent with the natural history of all animals, where basically people are taking every shortcut and headed to the rich food. And to go against that on a consistent basis, on a super consistent basis, to keep a really clean palate and keep yourself, you know, aim true, not easy to do. So the percentages of people that will attempt that and be successful will be low. The crutches are here. We do everything that we can to elucidate the difficulties. Nathan has committed his life to having an inpatient place, and so has Alan Goldhammer. It's like, hey, listen, Chef AJ has done everything that she can possibly do. She's literally stood on her head, okay? done everything possible. So, you know, that's, but do not beat yourself up if you have struggled and failed, for goodness sakes. Understand that this journey to go against your nature and to beat your genes in this domain is one of the most difficult, seemingly, it's unbelievably deceptive. It is the ultimate greased watermelon. Okay, so it seems like you can pick it up, and then it slips away. So the notion is
the whole eat less, move more doctrine that's out there. You know, people are like, oh, Instagram right. tells people that they need to do. It's and so people have this falsely communicated sense that it's all willpower, and then the willpower fails, and so they retreat to the psychological mumbo jumbo because there's nowhere else to go. So even if they do understand that the pleasure right. trap is a thing, everybody thinks that they yeah. have the willpower, they have the fortitude, they have the motivation to defeat it, that these laws of evolution don't apply to them. And so it's very, yeah. it is very deceptive. And this is what is part of the ego trap process, where people are just confused that they can't solve yeah. this problem, because they absolutely have PhDs in the problem, and they've been successful to some degree. Most yeah. people have been successful a few times, and they've lost 20 pounds and then they regained. Mm-hmm. And it's not like they don't know how to do it. So what's the problem? So contributes yeah. to enormous amounts of self-loathing and confusion and misinformation and retreat into excuses like psychological mumbo jumbo, which is yeah. going to be the name of my next book, by right. the way.
would you say that yeah. this creates an in-group out-group difference between the people with the skinny genes and people who don't have the skinny genes, and so the people with the skinny genes essentially are all saying the same thing even though it's wrong, but everyone's listening to them just because they look like they want to look like.
I don't know. I wouldn't want to generalize. I think the generalization I would make about skinny versus non-skinny in this domain is that the skinny people are very likely to think that people that are struggling are essentially self-indulgent and essentially that's the issue. Or if they're further misguided and deeply misunderstanding the situation, they're believing that the people that have weight problems have underlying psychological dynamics that need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, this actually goes on at True North mm-hmm. Health Center. We got doctors there that think that, which is just unbelievably disgusting to me, mm-hmm. by the way.
Well, it's ubiquitous. I mean, this is so we're the weird ones here.
Yes, it's a ubiquitous. People do not understand what is taking yeah. place here. Okay, what's taking place is that essentially, let me give an analogy. We're going to go and we're going to take 100 people out of, I don't know, Tuscany, okay? And so we're going to take sort of middle southern European genes. We're going to take 100 of those people, and we're going to put them in bikinis and boxer shorts, or briefs, you know, and we're going to take them down to Panama, and we're going to have them wander the beaches for 2 weeks with no shade. Okay. Now, what are we going to find? We're going to find some of them are burned to a crisp because they had some light skin. We're going to have some of them that are going to be moderately burned but have, you know, somewhat of a tan. They had medium skin. And then we're going to have some of them that have beautiful golden bronze because they had more melanin in their skin. Okay? And we could say, if we're one of the golden bronze ones, we could say, what's wrong with your skin? Why are you so incompetent? Okay? Why do you have that sunburn? What's the matter with you? What are you psychological problems that you have? What do you, quote, can't take the heat? What happened to you in your childhood?
Didn't get enough sun in your childhood. Yeah.
Okay. See, this is exactly what this is. And so because it's just sufficiently mystifying, it's just a little bit biologically complex, and the evolutionary psychology that is involved in this problem, it goes totally unappreciated by essentially everybody, that we wind up with psychological mumbo jumbo that looks just exactly like the Tuscany skin problem. Okay? So everybody is subject to the pressure of the sun. Some people don't wind up with much of a problem, i.e. skinny people are eating crap with both hands. They're eating exactly the same crap. How do I know? Because there's no salad bar restaurant in Elk Grove. So I know if I go into Chili's, I'm going to see a bunch of skinny people there, chomping down the same crap as the people in the booth right next to him, right? So the problem is ubiquitous. The outcomes are variants of genetics. And in order for, if you have the weight problem, i.e. you are a normal person, that if you're eating a super rich diet, you're going to get overweight, just like the average rat, if it's adding an overly rich diet, it's going to get overweight. The average person who's eating the super rich diet of the modern fare is in trouble. And in order for them to not be in trouble, they're going to have to do something unbelievably radical. They're going to have to go against the genetic code, directly against it, 180 degrees the opposite direction. Okay, so is this going to be difficult? You better believe it. Okay, what are the solutions? The solutions are piecemeal and numerous. They have to do with great, you know, tremendous commitment and control over your environmental circumstances. They have also specialized little things like taking breaks and going to rehab. They have a lot of stuff is involved here. Okay, so it's learning about the self-esteem mechanism and the relief from the self-loathing that comes with even short-term determined excellence. So there's a lot of pieces that go into this. But when it comes to this, you know, most profound, deep, wide, mysterious problem and the New Year's resolutions that rise every year around it, you know, hey, there's some things that you can do, and there's a true path towards how it is that you can have some success.
Thank you for that, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle. All right, so our next question, speaking of these, the psychodynamic theories with regards to health problems, our next question is on the same topic, which is, what do the doctors think about the work of Dr. John Sarno in curing chronic back pain using education of how the mind works as treatment? According to Dr. Sarno, childhood abuse can lead to rage in the unconscious mind and brain triggers, TMS, or I believe it's tension myositis, myositis syndrome, or chronic pain to repress this internal rage. And there have been hundreds of people who have supposedly cured their back pain and write about their story in his book, Healing Back Pain.
I'll let Doug just, he's on a roll. we've already, the Hulk has started to come out, so let's just let it go.
Oh my God. Okay. This is like totally absurd. All right, so this is 100% bogus. Now, Dr. Sarno, I sure was a sweet old guy.
Oh
apparently
my gosh,
he died
I'm so
recently.
Sorry about the dogs.
What's that?
Motown's just very excited about our topics tonight and just is barking up a storm in the other room. So I do apologize to okay. the listeners. I don't, right. you know, it's like that it's just going to, there's nothing I can do about it, unfortunately.
Motown just knows I'm on a roll. Yeah. Now, there's numerous reasons why probably Dr. Sarno thought about this. The one reason was that GI problems can absolutely be flared up as a result of stress. But there's a reason for this. It's part of our evolutionary design. So if you're being stalked by a tiger, or you essentially if you have anything that looks like a predator-prey situation or that's very threatening, it's going to escalate adrenaline, and adrenaline is going to immediately stop digestion. And it's going to, if it's acute enough, it'll cause you to want to pee and poop. Okay, that's because you need to get lighter so that you can run. And this is what's called being scared shitless, right? So this can also, when people have sensitive guts, if they've got ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or something like this, if they've got IBS, so when they get, if they get agitated, if they get adrenalized, then it can agitate their bowel process. So it's very clear that connection exists. So it's not too far away if you're sort of an open-minded doc or person. You start thinking, well, what about everything else? Okay, what about my throat cancer? Maybe I needed to say things and I repressed that, and that's why it is that I grew a tumor in my throat, you know, because I had this repressed rage that wanted to come out about, you know, screeching about how I was mistreated by my big brother or my mother or my uncle or my dad or whomever, right? So I want to point out that any of these cockamamie theories have absolutely no consilience with biology. Why would evolution cause you to have a tumor in your throat, you know, as a result of a battle for you not speaking up for yourself? Where is there any biological interest served by this? Where is there an evolutionary advantage to having back pain because you were abused in childhood and didn't speak up? It's like insane. Okay, this has zero consilience with evolution. It could not have been engineered inside human developmental biology. It couldn't have been. It's ridiculous. Okay, and so the whole concept is ridiculous, but it's not ridiculous if you're a Freudian and you've been influenced by Freudian thinking, which of course he was influenced by Freudian thinking. He undoubtedly had some friend who was a psychiatrist, and they're kicking things around. And he couldn't find the reason for the back pain. And so it turns out it must be psychogenic, which is a typical medical explanation when they can't figure out why things happen. You know, it happens to be that I know, after having spent, you know, 25 years working in a fasting facility, that I happen to know that people get really well from their low back pain, you know, pretty quickly in water fasting, which is something that Nathan will tell you because he's seen it. Okay, so I don't see exactly what psychological thing happened, you know, when we lock people down and strap them to the bed in the fasting facility and they scream about how their mother abused them, that at the same time we're not feeding them, you know, we're feeding them only water, and miraculously the back pain goes away.
They're releasing the trauma, Doug. Don't you? You have to get on board with the whole paradigm here.
Right.
Is that if they shout enough and they talk to somebody and they release it and they work through it and they break open the trauma pod, then it's released and they're healed.
Right.
And then it's fine. This is the process. So
This is Freudian crap, folks. This goes back to the late 1800s. It has enormous popular appeal. It is not true. It is not how we are designed. It makes no sense biologically. And it was, as I have said before, it's been one of the quiet little percolating frustrations of my existence, knowing full well that this is BS all the way down to the ground, that there's no truth in it. The quotes, science that supports Sarno is a joke. There is no science that supports us. That's like saying, you know, oh, well, they went and they interviewed 100 of these people and 75% of them said they were better. Oh, really? The people that went to him, believed in him, paid him, and then we asked them 10 years later? Yeah, that's like asking people, were you really abducted by the aliens when you said that you were abducted? Yes, I in fact was. They were little green men with little red antenna. It's just what I said 10 years ago. Okay. So of course, and then many, you know, there is zero scientific support for this. There's no support for anything even remotely like it anywhere. All of such theories are bogus. And the only thing that I'm happy about is that Dr. Jen Hawk figured out why it's a bipolar. And so that will become evident in the parts of our work that she's going to be the expert in, that she's going to be writing in the book that we're co-authoring on, that'll be out next year. Is she's going to explain to the world why this is such a massive, widespread delusion. And so this is not to pick on Dr. Sarno specifically, you know, well-meaning, misguided, miseducated, uneducated individual perpetrating an utterly typical representativist heuristic based psychodynamic bunch of garbage. Okay. Oh, well, you know, he get in line. Okay. But at least now I understand why this is so tenacious at a much deeper and more profound level. Thank goodness. And my New Year's resolution is to make sure I tell Dr. Hawk, thank you, you know, at least 50 more times for helping me see this clearly. And we're going to show the world how it works.
That's very kind. And this has come up before, and I know people have messaged me going, well, why don't you just answer it on the podcast? And first of all, it's a very complicated explanation, and would take a long time. But second of all, it is in the book, and we don't want to give it away before the book comes out. So we're not trying to be excessively cagey about it, but we are saving some things for the book. So, yeah.
Very good. All right.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you very, very much for doing this live broadcast for the first of the first show of the year. And we're looking forward to a very wonderful 2020. And I don't know about you guys, but I know I'm extremely excited for this book to come out and to watch this this unfold.
Yeah, likewise. It is a big New Year's resolution for both of us to work on it diligently.
Yes.
It's process over outcome.
Well, no. Maybe you can. Maybe you will.
That's right.
Maybe
we don't
want
to set expectations too high.
Beautiful.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.